How do we live as committed and observant Jews even in the most difficult times, such as we and those we love would each experience? This is a difficult topic. And we've brought together members of our community who have much experience in tackling the range of issues covered by end of life. Rabbi David Rosenbaum is a musmach, received a smicha from Yeshiva Greater Washington. He's been a congregational rabbi for the last 14 years, the last four as the rabbi of our shul, Young Israel Shum Emunah. He has counseled many individuals or relatives of those facing end-of-life questions. He's also the president of the Vaad HaRabbanim of Greater Washington. Dr. Theo Heller is a graduate of Georgetown Medical School. He has extensive research and clinical experience in the treatment of liver diseases. As such, he communicates with patients and their families, and quite important, as an observant Jew and member of the Camp Meir community, he understands the issues and has worked closely with Rabbi Rosenbaum. Many in our community have called on his expertise and great communication skills. There's a lot of material to cover, so we've opted for looking at the broad issues that come up in this area. There'll be some time, but not much, for Q&As, because of the amount of material. Also, the questions that you come up with frequently are very personal and private and anguished. You can contact also Rabbi Rosenbaum personally, and Dr. Heller will remain for some questions after this program. There will be some material mentioned here. I don't have any PowerPoints for you, any notes, but there will be some resources mentioned that will be available for you after the session. They are right there. You can get a copy. Don't look at them now because it shouldn't be picked up. And also, they'll distract you from what's important here is to focus on what we have up about us. I'll start with Rabbi Rosenbaum.
Thank you very much. Again, as Theo's mentioned, time is short, but I want to just begin on behalf of everyone to thank Max Rudman. I realized at some point in my stay here in Kent Mill that Max Rudman's full-time job is not working for the Greater Washington community, but it took me many years to believe it. And thank you for organizing another beautiful program. And, of course, thank you to Audrey and Bika Cohen for everything she does. And I must say I'm extremely humbled to just share a program with Dr. Theo Heller, besides being someone of a tremendous, tremendous wisdom, experience, expertise. The sacrifice and generosity of his time to the rabbis in the community, members of the community, is extremely extremely inspiring and beautiful, and we thank him very much. And I think I saw Leanne also, and that's definitely something for which we have to thank Leanne very, very much. As Max mentioned, this is an extremely sensitive topic. I just apologize ahead of time if there are comments that we make that in any way are hurtful to people, that bring back memories of very difficult times. In my own presentation, I do plan on referring in a very general way to different experiences I've had in dealing with patients and families. It might be you that the experience is referring to. It might not be you. I assure you, unfortunately, though I'm a young fellow, I live vicariously through many different people, and many of the experiences do have certain similarities. But I just want to begin by apologizing if I say anything that sparks a personal or emotional painful memory. I apologize ahead of time. I'm sorry, one more thing. We're really going to break the presentation up into four categories. First, we're going to talk about a general sort of philosophical perspective, and Theo and I will be alternating. We're going to talk about some practical issues, both in terms of interfacing with rabbis and doctors and things of that sort. And then I'll be getting into halachic issues, and again, Theo and I will be alternating throughout. And the last segment will be an interactive presentation, which I think I hope you'll find engaging. From a philosophical perspective, the way that, in my opinion, that Judaism views end-of-life issues, I think is really borne out by an interesting experience that I once had. There was a patient connected to someone from the community who, before they ever were admitted to the hospital, had a much lesser quality of life, as we would normally measure it, than the vast majority of us. The person suffered from different disabilities and things of that sort. And then, for a completely separate reason, they ended up being admitted to the hospital. Things were not going well. There were some end-of-life type of questions. Relatives of the patient asked me to attend a meeting in the hospital. between medical staff, the family, and myself. And the medical staff were tremendous. They explained things to me quite clearly. I was very appreciative. And after everything that I heard, my halachic opinion was the circumstances they were presenting, it was appropriate to continue to treat the matter aggressively. Maybe from later on in the program, you'll begin to get a little bit of a sense of some of the factors that would go into such a decision. One of the doctors who had been very patiently explaining things to me turns to me and with great care and courtesy said, "We understand you're a man of faith. We understand you probably believe in miracles, but we just want you to know one thing. No matter what happens, this woman's life is not going to change. It's not going to get any better. I guess a miracle could happen. You know about miracles better than we do, Rabbi, but this is very unlikely that her life is going to get better from all of this." And I turned to them and said, "The reason I'm telling the people they should continue with the treatment is not because I believe in miracles, thank you. The reason I'm encouraging further treatment is not because I believe in miracles. The reason I'm encouraging further treatment is because God gives us our life." Right? We say in Adon Olam, "B'yado afkid ruchi, b'yesi shan v'yayira." We give our spirit over to Him when we go to sleep, and when we wake up, He gives it back to us. It's a gift from God. We have roles in this world. He, in His abundant kindness and wisdom, gives us halachos also, gives us laws, gives us guidance. There are times where it is appropriate to let a person die. There are times where it is appropriate to stop aggressive treatment. That's also a very real part of halacha. But the reason to keep on doing it is not because we think necessarily there's going to be a miracle and the person's going to be dancing in front of us in shul next week. The reason to keep on doing it is because we believe very firmly that we have to let God end the person's life when God deems it appropriate. And many times that involves our expending all of our efforts. And sometimes that involves, with halachic guidance, stepping back and letting things take their own course. But that's the reason. Because God gives all of us our lives and we follow His edicts. It's interesting, many, many times, and this is anecdotal, and this is not the point, but many, many times I've visited people in shiva houses after their loved one has passed, and they felt, for whatever reason it was, that when the person ultimately did pass, there was a real value to them passing at such a time. That there was pressure that they should stop treatment, and sometimes they continued based on guidance, sometimes they stopped based on guidance, and many times it ended up that the person passed away, and either something else beautiful happened that would not have happened if they would have followed the advice of stopping aggressive treatment right away, or they passed away at a very significant time. It's just a little bit of something to think about. And I just want to close this segment with an experience that I had when I was in Bethesda. This is probably 12, 13 years ago. There was a parent of a congregant of mine in Bethesda, and this was a person who had grown up observant in an Orthodox way, and really had stopped that lifestyle, which was his own decision. And his child had become observant. Okay, he normally didn't do Shabbos or anything of that sort. The child did. So they had called me and asked for some guidance. Again, they were given an option that would have ended the person's life earlier. At the time, I did not feel qualified to answer their questions. I took their information. I spoke to a Beinemer. I got back to them. And his feeling was they should continue aggressive treatment at the time. The person passed away when it was the right time for the person to pass away. I believe, if I remember correctly, the fellow passed away on a Sunday. The family was gathered with him for Shabbos. They wanted to, it was very clearly a serious situation. And his child was observant. His grandchildren were observant. They were getting together in the hospital room. They were having Friday night dinner. And they sang Shalom Aleichem, and they sang Eish Haschayil, and they made Kiddush. Now, when this man was well, he wasn't interested in these things. When Kiddush was over, he was conscious, wasn't able to speak, but he was conscious. When Kiddush was over, all of a sudden he started motioning to them and pointing to his mouth. that he wanted to have a little bit of the kiddish grape juice himself too. Wanted to have that experience. Just it's somewhat of a beautiful story. We have no idea how we focus so much on quality of life and what can the person do, what can the person not do. God puts us in this world. You know, for this one person, the last Shabbos of his life, he was able to do something in honor of Shabbos. And again, who knows what was going on in his mind, but in some sense, it was a little bit of a circle. So this is just on a philosophical level, a basic perspective. There's halacha. Halacha guides us. We'll talk a lot about nuances of halacha later on. But life is a gift from God and a mission from God. And we really have to follow his edicts when we decide what to do, heaven forbid, at the end of such circumstances.
Thank you, Rabbi Rosenbaum. I too wanted to start with first thanking Max for organizing this and for being the driver and putting up with my inefficiencies and really having such a vision. And Bikur Cholim is incredible. Audrey Siegel does a fantastic job, and the Chesed committees of all the shuls in the area are really something I think we should all be proud of.
Dr. Heller?
Yes.
Can you speak up a little bit? It's hard to hear with the noise next door. If you can speak up a little bit, it would be appreciated.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
So I started by thanking Max and mentioning that Bikur Cholim and the Chesed committees it's something that we're privileged to have in our communities. And I also wanted to start with apologizing if I appear insensitive in any way or if I offend anyone in any way. And that I hope not to do that, but please don't misunderstand my clinical approach sometimes with don't confuse the clinical approach with insensitivity. Fikavo says, Asel Achara. And the importance of having a Rav in this situation cannot be understated. Rabbi Beryl Wine wrote an essay on rabbinic decision making, and he published it in a journal called Medicine and Jewish Law. It's from 1993, and I think it's really good to read. There are a lot of things he covers, but one of the most important things I think he covers is that rabbis, that's not so important, but doctors can make mistakes and sometimes play God. Forgive the expression. And he notes that the Rashba says that all are human and all can err, and that this is an important consideration when starting this. He proposes a very strong solution, and he outlines that communication really solves this, that the ability to communicate, to talk to the relevant people, and to have people talking to each other directly is crucial. In his discussion about choosing a rabbi, he points out that Aruch HaShulchan says that a rabbi should also find a doctor. Aselach HaRofe. I'm not telling Rabbi Rosenbaum what to do.
I found mine.
But he points out that this is very important. And he said that if a rabbi should make decisions in this situation, he should understand what the situation is. Not all poskim agree with that. There are definitely poskim who say, you just have to understand if it's dangerous or not. It doesn't matter what the details are, but the majority opinion is not that. And Rav Moshe Feinstein was famous for having a profoundly close relationship with Dr. Fred Rosner, and we've all benefited tremendously in terms of our understanding of medical halacha from the responsa that they wrote and from Dr. Rosner's writings. And furthermore, Rabbi Feinstein was famous for Zitzal, was famous for even going to a second and third doctor if he didn't feel he understood what the first had said. Rabbi Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz has written extensively about need for clarity of opinion, clarity of thought, discussion, and understanding issues. So, if I can borrow a phrase from the rabbi, Ashreinu, we're particularly fortunate to have Rabbi Rosenbaum at Shomrei Emunah. His humility and sensitivity are balanced by a tremendous personal strength and passion, and it's all inspired and fixed in an unwavering devotion to Torah, which I think is really important. His desire to do the right thing and his deep caring for people, he'll ask me weeks later what happened to someone, is something we could all learn from, and we have all benefited from. I've been repeatedly humbled by Rabbi Rosenbaum's desire to understand the medical issues involved. He has no hesitation in asking the correct questions, and he always asks the correct questions. He has an ability to sort the signal from the noise, and so that he can make appropriate decisions. We're fortunate. This communication is crucial, because in difficult situations and in crisis, facts become distorted. And to paraphrase Daniel Patrick Monahan, while we're all entitled to our own opinions, we're not entitled to our own facts. So we have to make sure that the clarity of thought and the communication and the ability to speak between team members is not impeded. A further important component of this process is to understand what framework underpins each of the team members' approach. So Rabbi Rosenbaum approaches end-of-life issues from a Torah perspective. What's the underlying conceptual framework for the average American physician, and in truth, I have to be honest, the average American patient? In layman's terms, the biggest driver of decision-making is quality of life. The rabbis already alluded to that, and the problem with that term is that what different people understand by quality of life is not the same. There's a very wide spectrum of what quality of life really means. And a rose is not a rose is not a rose. So we have to be careful. And I'd like to go through a current example, something that was in the news recently. A patient, more than one patient sent this to me. It was featured on the CNN website repeatedly for days before this patient's death. She's a 29-year-old, attractive, vivacious woman who was newly married and diagnosed with an incurable brain tumor. And what she did was she moved to Oregon because they have assisted suicide, physician-assisted suicide in Oregon. And she arranged to die 2 days after her husband's birthday, which was October 2nd, which she did. And the reason she did that was because she felt that treatment would be futile, even although she acknowledged and understood that treatment would prolong her life, and that for most of that time she would have a near normal quality of life, as defined by the secular world. She felt that the burden on herself and her husband was unacceptable. So that's okay, that's an exception. Oregon is the only state in the nation which has laws like that. But I have to say that the average American physician, and more than that, the average patient, would see that as heroic. Almost heroic, and as displaying tremendous strength and courage. So that's obviously not the Torah perspective. Furthermore, I should just say as a caveat that her approach does not reflect current medical opinion. Her doctors clearly felt she should be approached and treated and go through treatment and have radiation and chemo surgery. I don't want you to think for a second that her doctors were telling her not to do this. This was her decision. I'm talking about the response I've seen in my colleagues and in people when I've spoken to them about this case. And I'm talking about the patients who sent this to me. So when a doctor talks to you about quality of life, it's important that you understand where they're coming from. I use the extreme to illustrate effect. Okay. An extension of this is that doctors might feel the patient should be persuaded to be DNR. So there are extensive studies on this. Do not resuscitate. I'm going to explain that. There are extensive studies on this. The Mayo Clinic took a group of patients who had a terminal neurological condition, which typically takes about 10 or 15 years for people to die. And they followed them, and they repeatedly, at different courses through their illness, asked the caregivers, the doctors, and the patients what they thought in terms of their quality of life. And the only thing that was certain at the end of the study was that doctors are terrible at estimating what patients' quality of life is. We have no idea what the patients find valuable. Family members weren't much better, but that's because family members are very concerned about patient suffering. But if you're concerned about patient suffering, address that as opposed to making the patient do not resuscitate. So as family members and as patients, we should understand that we have to address the real issues and not necessarily the easy issues. This whole discussion is compounded by the fact that in the state of Maryland, it's a legal requirement when a patient transitions between different levels of care to fill out the MOLST form. There's a copy of that up here. You can all get it. It's a very complicated form, although it's not made by the federal government. It was made by an emergency room physician, which is even worse. There are a number of pages and instructions and... I have a number of problems with it. First of all, it treats some of this like an a la carte menu. I'll take the antibiotics, but not the dialysis. How do you know what the situation's going to be? How could you guess at something like that ahead of time? I don't want to discuss that. Real issue that I wanted to go through was the first page, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But this is the page that has to be filled in. When you transition between levels of care, So into hospital, out of a hospital, into a nursing home, into rehab. Primary care physicians are meant to ask you this when you come into their offices. And they're meant to readdress it with you on a regular basis, but they won't necessarily do that. The way that they're trying to ensure that this gets done is that you can bill for a high level of care if you mention this to your patient. There are four options, really. To do CPR, chest compressions, and intubate a patient. The second is to not do CPR, but to intubate. The third is not to intubate, not to do CPR, but to provide all other levels of care. And the last is to do palliative or supportive care. And that gets into hospice, which we're not going to discuss here, and maybe that will be a topic for a later session if people are interested. So you should understand that when the doctor comes to you and wants to discuss this, it's not because there's impending doom. It's not because something bad is going to happen or they think you're about to arrest. They're coming to you because they have to come to you and discuss this. You should understand that often their approach is different to your approach. We've already discussed that. And you should understand that the most important distinction between this form and the traditional living will is subtle but actually crucial. Living will says, in the event of a standard legal language in Maryland, D.C. and Virginia, is in the event of a terminal condition, I would wish the following. Or in a vegetative state, I would wish the following. The most form says, in my current state, the way I am right now, which is very different, right? So what happens is a patient will come in, and I'll say to them, so I should explain, I have a second job. I'm moonlight in the emergency room at Suburban Hospital where I do admissions. I do about 500 admissions a year, roughly, over the last 20 years. And as Max pointed out, the patients I deal with are often at my in my primary job are often sick. So we have a lot of opportunity to discuss these things. So when a patient comes in, they say, I have a living will. I don't want to be resuscitated. Because they all have visions of Karen Ann Quinlan. And I say to them, well, the living will says in a terminal condition, and we're asking the way you are now. And they initially don't listen to the question. They just say, no, I don't want to be resuscitated. And then I explain the way you are now means in your current state of health, not terminal, not vegetative. You could say that aging is a terminal condition, but what you're coming into the hospital for now. And then the response is usually a little bit different. It says, I would want to be resuscitated if my pneumonia gets worse or if my heart stops, if I have a heart attack. I would want that. And this is not written in stone. This can be changed. Right? So it's important to understand that. Maryland Medical Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment.
There are copies of that in the session you can pick up.
Yeah. So a few quick points to end this session. Niels Bohr said prediction is difficult, especially when it comes to the future. I think it's very true. Jakob Friedman, who is a famous physician and a Frum Bentora Balmides, he's retired, he was the intensive care chief at the University of Chicago. It's a top institution, highly, highly experienced physician, a sensitive man. So he did a study of himself over 1 month in the intensive care unit, and what he wanted to know is how good am I at predicting death or survival? And he said, every patient I see I'm going to put into four categories, definitely die, probably die, definitely live, and probably live. And I'm also going to guess how, if those who are definitely going to die, how long they're going to survive. Okay. So he was very good, 100% accuracy at definitely die. He was very bad in terms of which day. From 3 days to 30 days, he was way off. But he was very good at telling who was definitely going to die. He was reasonably good at telling who was definitely going to live. But when it came to probable, which most physicians would translate to patients as definite, he was very bad, about 50%. 50, at best, 80% in some settings. So this was said a long time ago. Rabbi Enem as itself once pointed this out to me, that the Rosh said, the doctor's certainty is sometimes the rabbi's maybe. And I think that's still true. I think that we still have to hold by that. I also want to point out that resuscitation may be futile. And what I mean by that is that there are situations where if someone needs resuscitation, and I don't really want to speak about odds, but I will here for a minute. There's some settings where 30-day survival is zero. with other situations where it's less than 1%. So some people have said to me, if only they resuscitated someone. But really, there are some situations where it is futile. There are other situations where an excellent outcome occurs more than 50% of the time, even 70, 80% of the time. So we have to distinguish the setting. We're going to come back to that. We have to distinguish needing the ventilator for pneumonia or a car accident versus terminal illness. And we have to think about the severity of the illness. The setting is very important. Dying is not inherently painful. There are very few patients who die in pain, and I think that's important. I think the patients' families and the people standing around the bedside often suffer more than the patients do. There are some settings where death can be very painful, but those are exceptional. People who have metastatic cancer to bone, for example, that can be terrible. But in most settings, death in itself is not painful, and halacha is very, very generous in terms of pain control, even when it might put the patient at risk. Not assisted suicide, not euthanasia, chalil v'chas, I'm not talking about that, but controlling pain. So that should not be a fear. I don't want anyone to walk out thinking death is painful, person suffers, and then they die. It's not necessarily so. It usually, almost always is not. The last thing I want to say in this session is that health is a dynamic process. There are lots of twists, turns, and surprises. So what is appropriate may change during the course of an illness. And that's why doctors see patients every day. Right? Because we don't know what's going to happen day to day. And if we were so good about predicting the future, as Niels Bohr said, we could just see the patient initially and not leave them alone until they discharge. It doesn't work that way. This also means, but the importance of that for this session is that, like voting, you've got to do it early and often. You've got to see a rabbi early and often. You've got to talk to your rabbi early and often, because the process changes during the course. And I would say that there's an amazing biological fact that once someone gets smicha, they no longer need sleep. It also applies to MDs, but I'm saying it, if I may, with all due respect, that it's really important to involve a rabbi early and often. I cannot emphasize that enough. I've heard patients say afterwards, we should have asked the rabbi. I've never heard anyone say, I'm sorry we asked the rabbi. Right? And Rabbi Beryl Wein also in that article also discusses asking too many rabbis, going to 3, 4, 5 rabbis until you get what you want to hear. That I'm going to address that in the second portion of what I say. I once had a conversation again with Rabbi Enema Zitzal about asking shilas in the setting. And I realized that this is so important, because one of the worst things that can happen to me, and please don't misunderstand, I'm not being insensitive, it's a terrible thing, but one of the worst things that happens to me is that my patients die. That's the worst. That's the end of it. But if I make a mistake with halacha, that's olam haba. That's forever. Right? That's a whole different category of things. So I realized that that's one of the most important reasons for me to ask shilas, and so I still do. And I think I would say to all of you that we are born al pi halacha. We don't put treif in our mouths. We don't knowingly switch on lights on Shabbos. We live al pi halacha, and that we should ensure that end of life questions are also dealt with al pi halacha. With that, I'll hand over again.
Yeah. Okay. Theo, I wish I would have spoken to you before I went to yeshiva. Thank you. I just want to deal with some practical points that people should and can think about now. Heaven forbid, before a person is in the hospital. Theo mentioned the MOST form. Theo also mentioned living wills. There's a document that I think also there's access to. The Agudah has one. The RCA has one. We have copies of both here, which is frequently referred to as a halachic living will. Let me just explain generally what that is. What that is that if a person, heaven forbid, is in a situation in the hospital that they're not able to make their own decisions, they appoint someone as being their, for lack of a better term, essentially their medical representative to make decisions for them. Frequently on these forms, you're asked to fill out the medical representative and an alternate if for some reason the representative is not available. And this, I don't believe this has legal significance per se in the hospital, but it's relevant to the representatives. It gives guidance to the representatives as to a rabbi that they should consult if there are halacha questions. And the opportunity that that rabbi's asleep, I guess, I don't know, an alternate rabbi, if that rabbi is not available. Besides the fact that it's essential that, if heaven forbid, a patient is not able to make their own decisions, someone should be clearly designated as the representative, you are doing your children, your extended families, a great, great kindness if you tell them, whether it be in that form, whether it be just in discussion, which rabbi you want them to contact. I can't tell you how many times I've received calls. Again, generally, if the patient is a congregant of mine, it's pretty clear that I'm the one that's supposed to be contacted. Many, many times, for whatever reason it is, the patient is not affiliated with the synagogue, whatever, there are different children with different rabbis, and they all start calling different people. So when I get a call like that, normally the first question I ask is there another rabbi being consulted? Do you have clarity as a family as to which rabbi you should be consulting? If you think of all the difficulty that a family is going through at that juncture, then on top of that, one rabbi says one thing, one rabbi says the other thing. That happens sometimes in life. None of you might be aware of that, but rabbis say different things. You're doing a great, great kindness. Just another thing to, and just to give an example, I had very recently, it was a setting, it was a day that you couldn't make phone calls. There was a family from the Kent Mill area who unfortunately had a patient who had to go to the hospital, and they saw me and they started asking me questions, and I gave them some guidance based on the situation as it was. Then I called them after Shabbos to try to be a mensch, and I asked how the patient is doing. I could tell they were a little bit uncomfortable, but they were extremely polite about it. They said, you know what, we actually, after Shabbos, we found their directive, and it mentioned Rabbi so-and-so as the primary contact. And I said, great, and best of luck, and that's fine. But if that hadn't been, so this would have been the situation, Rabbi so-and-so was, there was a parent and then two children. Rabbi so-and-so was one child's rabbi. I was the rabbi that the other child thought was logical. So imagine if they wouldn't have filled out a form. So then, they would have. What if we wouldn't have said the same thing? But there was clarity. That's a great thing. On these forms, it normally has an alternate that, in all seriousness, makes perfect sense. I'll also just mention another practical thing. Many times, I see lawyers in the room also, many times we fill out these forms and we totally forget about them. Forgive me for saying this. I would bet good money that there are a number of people in this room who have filled out such a form, and Rabbi Einemer is the rabbi on the form. I'm being serious. He's not with us. To our terrible loss, he's not with us. And that's just one example. It's important. So obviously it's important, I would think, in law, it's important every now and then to review these forms and things like that. But just besides that, it's very valuable to have an alternate mention. Another value in thinking about these things ahead of time and speaking to the people who you designate as a representative and alternate representative. Again, that's not necessarily the rabbi. That's this child versus that child. Same point, by the way. I've had numerous times in the hospital where children feel different ways. Okay, so you're doing your children a great chesed if you say, child A is the primary point of contact. And if child A is not available, then child B. And Zehu, that's it. Whoever you designate, it's very worthwhile to discuss with your designated individual what your own personal wishes are. We'll get into it a little bit later, though much of the halachic issues of end of life are appropriate or not appropriate, and it's really not up to the patient's wishes. There are areas in halachic questions end of life where it really depends on the patient's wishes. And the basic issue is how aggressive within the realm of halacha a patient would like to be treated. To be very candid with you, when I deal with families that do not have clarity from the patient and the patient is not up to making such a decision, my normal assumption, honestly, is that once halacha allows foregoing aggressive treatment, my normal assumption is that that would be the patient's preference and that they would rather not have a longer ordeal than is halachically necessary. But I've had situations where a patient has told the family very clearly, and I don't I don't think of this as good or bad. I think of it as a matter of preference. The patient has told the family very clearly, if I'm ever ill, I want you to do whatever it takes. Whatever, whenever. And again, and halacha allows for that. There is a very, very end of situation point in halacha where that's not even an option, that the context of being a goseis, that's a whole other question, how do you define a goseis? But that was the patient's personal preference. And you know what? The family knew. And kol hakavod, really, hats off to the family. It was very, as Theo mentioned before, it was very difficult for the family because they were seeing their loved one die and it was protracted, but this is what their loved one wanted. So I would, if you take the time to fill out such a form, which I would strongly encourage you to do, it's very worthwhile to talk to the represented. First of all, the individual should know that they're listed on the form. The individual should have copies of such a form, but they should understand what your own personal preferences are. One more practical point, once it gets to the hospital, this is something that Theo touched on, but I just want to reiterate it. Brilliant, intelligent, experienced people frequently do not think straight when their loved one is in the hospital. It's just the reality of the situation. I have one specific example in mind where the doctor, for whatever reason is, the doctor was trying to press a person to do X based on every single halachic conversation we had had beforehand. And this was a very strong-willed, very intelligent person. Based on every single discussion we had beforehand, there's no reason in the world why X would be the logical thing halachically to do. The person called me up. He said, should I do X? I said, no, don't do X. He told me that he does. I said, don't do X. And then he said to me, yeah, but it seems to be really the appropriate thing to do. And I explained it to him, and he was fine. But it was just such a striking example. And again, this is one of the most put-together, straight-thinking people I've ever met. In the hospital, we're under great stress, and there are people telling us things. As Theo mentioned before, it really makes sense to ask questions regularly throughout the process.
I'll be a little bit shorter this time. So this is very practical. This section, I wanted to be very practical. I wanted to cover some of the nitty-gritty of hospitalization. And I'll start with an 82-year-old patient who came into the hospital at night. I saw her towards the end of it, the morning, and the end of her admission process. And she said to me, I saw the triage nurse, the emergency room doctor, I saw you, the night nurse on the ward, the day nurse on the ward, the day doctor on the ward, the two specialists. I've seen 13 people. Who's running the show? How can you keep anything straight? I'm sick, exhausted, and delirious. And who's making decisions? Where's my doctor? And the food is terrible. So you can understand that it's not easy. You can understand that for anyone, that's really not an easy situation, right? Even if you have your head straight. And compound that with four children at the bedside, grandchildren, each with different opinions. Guilt coming into it, I didn't spend enough time with mom. Anger coming at it into it, I've taken care of mom for the last 10 years. Where have you been? Now you show up as she's dying. You can imagine all these things. So I think all of this starts long before you get into the emergency room. I think all of this starts now, today. You should talk to your rabbi. You should have your family know what you want. You should talk to your doctors. Make sure your primary care knows what you want. You should fill in a halachic living will, as the rabbi said. Appoint a healthcare power of attorney. In other words, sign who's going to make decisions for you if you can't. I think that's the most important thing that you can do. And in the hospital, understand that all of these people are here to help you. They're working for you. You're paying them. Right? You're paying their salaries. So no one is malicious. Everyone is trying to help. They may be coming from different perspectives or different belief systems, but that doesn't make them bad. So you've got to, in a way, step back. Approach them with kindness, and this is particularly important for the family members. I know you're all thinking, who would do this? But in crisis, we all do this. I found myself doing it with my father, with my grandmother. So I found myself saying, hey, you've got to stop, step back, think about it carefully, because you're not behaving rationally. People become angry and mean. Healthcare professionals are trained to deal with this, but you'll definitely get much further by keeping an even keel. Sometimes healthcare professionals are even told that it's the doctor or the nurse's fault that this happened or the patient's ill. That's not true. We know that you don't mean that. But it doesn't help to then try and persuade the same doctor that you've been yelling at or the same nurse that you've been yelling at that you've got a different perspective on what quality of life means. So I think it's really important to see this as a team and to work as a team. So the first rule, I'm going to give you six rules. First rule, for the patient, not the doctor, for the patient is do no harm. Particularly because it may not be clear who you're talking to, be nice to all. I was once in a setting where the head of the department walked into a patient's room and the family member said, can you take the food tray out? So he did. He took it out, gave it to the, put it where the food trays go, and then he came back. The person was on the cell phone, and he waited. And then she thought, well, she couldn't understand why he was back. She thought he was the schlepper. And then he explained who he was, and suddenly she felt very bad. Right? So you don't know who you're dealing with. Not everyone wears a white coat. Second, ask people to introduce themselves. If they forgot, ask them. And if you forget who they are, ask them again. Third, identify family spokesmen to coordinate communication. That's very important for a number of reasons. First of all, if there are 12 family members, the healthcare team can't spend 12 times the amount of time each day. It's not a reasonable thing to expect. The second thing is myself and my sister with my father. She speaks to the healthcare team, gets one story. A different member of the healthcare team gives me a different story. And then we think we're not telling each other the truth. And you build rumors and mistrust. So, third, identify family spokesman. Fourth, identify key team members. So you want to know who on the team is important. So the most important term to learn is the hospitalist. That's an internist inside the hospital. That's why your doctor doesn't come to the hospital anymore, because hospitalists take care of patients in the hospital. They may change every day, every week, every 3 days, but that team is your quarterback. That team who's being paid to talk to you and educate you. So they're the key people. Next rule is identify the key component of the illness. So you want to know if it's a lung problem, the pulmonologist will be coming by, and they're making those decisions. So while you want to spend time with the hospitalist and understand what the hospitalist is telling you, you want to build a relationship with the key specialist or the key problem. And that might change. And different people from the practice might be coming. So nurses change, doctors change, specialists change. It's overwhelming. So next, keep a notebook. This is Rabbi Rosenbaum's suggestion. And I think it's a great suggestion. And I see a lot of patients do this. But I never really thought about it until Rabbi Rosenbaum said it. You can keep a notebook. Doctors will get defensive. You're writing it down for the lawsuit. Make sure you spell my name incorrectly. But in a non-aggressive, non-threatening way, you can keep notes. Just so that you know yourself, because you forget from moment to moment in crisis. And remember, it's a dynamic process. Next, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to ask. I'm going to come back to that. Speak to an outside physician, get a second opinion. But usually, when people talk about a second opinion, it's a problem with communication. It's a differing in approach. It's not necessarily the fact that the diagnosis is in question or that the treatment's in question. In my experience, usually when people want a second opinion, it's because they don't like the doctor or the hospital or the nurses, or because they're just so angry and can't accept the illness. Because it's so hard for them to accept that their parent is really dying. It's not easy, or their loved one. And so in that anger, this is well described, the different stages of grieving. In that anger, in that moment, in that flailing, they say to you, I want a second opinion. I'll tell you a quick story. I know I said I'll be shorter, but when I was an intern, I'd come from South Africa. And South Africa is very different in the sense that we are a little bit less direct. And I was at Georgetown as an intern, my first week on the job, and I had a patient who was admitted to the hospital to die, had cancer for a long time, was coming in to pass away. And he died within hours. So I went into the room and I looked at the patient, examined the patient, and I turned around to the family and I said, I think he's passed away. And the family said to me, you think? You should know you're a doctor. We want a second opinion. Now, mind you, this person came in to die. And there was no question. But in the moment, they lost it. So I went and I found a nurse. I gave her my white coat. I said, go in and say, he's dead. So she went in and she said, he's dead. She didn't even look at the patient. They wrote a letter to the hospital saying, the first doctor needs help. The second one was wonderful. So for the rest of residency, I was teased as the thinker. So, but it's important to understand that in crisis, we don't always act rationally. So that shouldn't stop you. This is the sixth and last rule. Don't be scared. Don't be scared of the illness. It's not in the doctor's hands. Not in the rabbi's hands. The only hand that's in is Hashem. None of us know. It's not under any of us our control. It really isn't under the doctor's control. Sometimes you think the patient's getting better and they don't. Other times you're sure they're going to die and they survive. I already discussed that. So understand that it's not under your control, my control, anyone's control. And we have to accept that. Don't be scared to disagree. Don't be scared to stand up. Not in an aggressive way, again, in a nice way. Don't be scared. Lastly, to go back to Rabbi Beryl Wine, mistakes do happen, but they're not as common as you think they are. And without question, as Rabbi Wine pointed out, the absolute solution to fix the overwhelming majority of mistakes is free and easily available. It's communication. It's involving a team, making sure that the team members speak to each other, a rabbi, doctor, yourself, family members, and making sure that you're all in the same parsha. And I think that that usually makes things much easier. And if there is a death, Chalil Vachas, it makes it much easier and leaves everyone with a sense of peace as a sense of anguish. And that would be my prescription.
Okay, what I'd like to do now is I'd like to just, on a general level, go through some of the major halachic issues that touch on end of life. I want to be very, very clear. Every situation is different. One small detail could make a major difference. I say that for two reasons. One is it could be someone will hear something today and feel that that didn't fit with something they heard or something they experienced. The odds are very high for the general stuff that I'm talking about. The odds are very high that it's, as Theo said before, something about communication. That maybe there was some other detail that you don't even remember from the earlier story or experience or something like that. That's one reason it's important to realize that halachic decisions can change based on specific details. The other is I just want to reiterate, even if a person feels this is extraordinarily clear and they review it every night before they go to bed, if heaven forbid a family is in the hospital with a patient, believe me, it's very hard to think clearly and remember everything. So it's really very important to ask a halachic authority when these things come up. So just a few general points. When I receive a call about a person who is facing end-of-life decisions, the very first question that I ask is the current illness a fatal illness? Meaning, will they die from this illness? We, as Theo said, we all pass at one point or another, but it's a very important aspect in halacha, in psak. If the person's current illness is something that is incurable, just to give an example, the person is suffering from an advanced stage of cancer, and there's nothing that can be done at this point to cure the cancer. Let's say they are definitely going to die within the next 6 months, let's say. And now the only question is prolonging life another month. You know, will they live 3 months or will they live 4 months? That's a very different situation in halacha than the person is ill. It's they might get better. They are in a curable condition. Honestly, generally speaking, from a halachic perspective, it's not called a real end-of-life discussion unless the person is suffering from an incurable illness that one way or another they will die within 6 months, a year, different opinions, but something along those lines. That is the first and foremost question. That's the first thing I ask people when they call me. Now, relative to that, and this is where the real issue of personal preference comes in, is the patient currently in pain? So if the person could live for another 5 years and they're currently in pain, I'm terribly sorry that they're in pain, but halacha would dictate that we have to continue to aggressively treat the person. If the person is not going to live for 6 months, but in terms of pain, they're not in any pain. That's also not really an issue. Every moment of life, as I'm sure people heard from Rabbi Inuzakon Baruch many, many times, every moment of life is a gift of God. The real question begins if the person is not going to be cured from this fatal illness, from this imminently fatal illness, and they either are in pain, or the proposed treatment will be one which causes them pain. In such a circumstance, there's tremendous allowance in halacha to help them and be not as aggressive for the sake of saving them from that pain. I hope I'm stating myself clearly. Okay. Now, Eve, this is extremely important. As Theo mentioned, hopefully we'll have another session about hospice at some later juncture. Heaven forbid, we wouldn't want to give Max nothing else to do with his time. But the other point that's very important, that this is greatly emphasized, is there are three basics: nutrition, hydration, and oxygen. These three things, even if the person is suffering from a fatal illness, from an imminently fatal illness, even if the person is in pain, we can't say the person is in pain and therefore we're not going to feed them anymore. We're not going to give them hydration anymore because that will end it quicker. That, from a halach, forgive my bluntness, but that from a halachic viewpoint is considered killing the person. You're starving the person to death. You can't do that. There's a very big difference between not being aggressive in all aspects of treatment and not giving the person basic physical needs. Okay? It's very important to realize that, and hopefully we'll give an example of that in a few moments. It's very important to realize that facts change over the course of a hospital stay. Situations change. And this, again, goes back to the importance of the team and keeping everybody in the team in the loop with yourself and with others. Maybe this should have gone more in the practical category, but I'll just mention from personal experience, I found the more the medical staff sees that the patient's family is interfacing with the rabbi, the more candid they will be with the rabbi. It's very interesting. I was actually once out of town when someone from the shul had a very serious situation with their parent, and they set up a conference call. It was not a conference call. Everyone in the hospital, the doctors, the family member were in a room on speakerphone, and I was on the phone. And it was very interesting. So I asked certain questions. I got certain answers. And the family member, this was maybe a little more than needed to be done, but the family member was very assertive. He kept on saying, like, when another doctor would say something, he would stop everything. He said, okay, Rabbi, did you hear that? Does that change anything? And they clearly saw, I'm not saying you have to do that, but they clearly saw how important it was to the family member that I was plugged into this. And I found, it might have been my imagination, but I found over the course of the discussion, they began to give my questions more detailed answers because they saw that this was not just like, as we would say, to be Yotze, so he could look me in the eye at the funeral or something, he really wanted the right answers. Two more things. One additional thing I want to mention is that we see it in many other aspects of medicine intersecting with Jewish law. I'll give you an example. If a pregnant woman goes into an OBGYN and asks, should I fast on Yom Kippur? So they'll always tell you, don't fast on Yom Kippur. It was interesting. My wife once was at an OBGYN, and as she was pregnant, and as she's going out, it was the last point for Yom Kippur, as she was going out, he said, have a good fast. And she said, wow, I'm impressed. This fellow is... And they said, but you should keep on drinking throughout Yom Kippur. You should have a good fast. And yet, if you get a frum OBGYN on the phone, and Baruch Hashem is a wonderful frum OBGYN who helps me many, many times in the community, I'll ask about specific circumstances. And sometimes they'll tell me the person shouldn't fast, and I want to hear that. I tell them. Many, many times they'll tell me, no, this is fine. They should just make sure to drink a lot before. He gives me signs that I do pass on to the person. If certain indications happen, you should break your fast on Yom Kippur. That's a classic example of a wonderful medical professional who doesn't necessarily appreciate where we're coming from, might give true medical information, but the weight is not necessarily the way we would do it. And so to be candid with you, sometimes, occasionally, I'll hang up the phone or leave the hospital, whatever it is, from a conversation with the doctor, and I'll just tell the family, and I'll learn the time to get back to you. And almost always that time is because I want to call a friend doctor. I'll give you one guess as to what I normally call. but I want to call a friend doctor. And just, again, I don't share the name. It's not appropriate. I share the general medical information. And I ask, is what I was told plausible? Or maybe am I missing something? Or maybe is there something I should come back and ask? I don't mean for a moment that the medical staff was not being forthright with me. I'm sure they were. But sometimes the medical staff doesn't necessarily appreciate the issue with the same weight with which we view it. People might be wondering, we have not said anything about brain death today. Brain death is an extremely complex area. I'll be very candid. That's the one issue in end-of-life Shilas that I just ask some questions, and I take down the answers, and I call a rabbi bigger, more knowledgeable than I, more experienced with these matters than I. I would not feel comfortable answering the brain death question. And I ask, to be honest with you, many rabbis throughout the country, far more experienced than I, would say the same thing. So I wish I could give you something that I would stand by. And honestly, even if I could, it would probably be a very complex discussion that might not have so much practical implications. The broad points that I want to just review one more time are the most important questions in most circumstances in end-of-life situations are, is the patient suffering from an imminently fatal illness that is, whatever is done, they're not going to be cured from that illness, and they will, let's say, pass away within the next 6 months, for example. And is the patient experiencing pain, or is the proposed treatment going to give the patient pain? If either of those are major reasons, if it is a fatal, but you need both pieces of it. If it is a fatal illness and there is going to be pain, that there's real area in halacha to say, okay, you don't have to do it. But even then, there are three basics that we really need to do: nutrition, hydration, and oxygen. And by the way, just as an aside, a question that comes up has to do with medications. Let's say there's certain types of medications that have been, it's not a major treatment to just have a medication in the line. That's a question. But nutrition, hydration, oxygen are the basics. I will take questions at the end. We'll take questions at the end. What we're going to do now, I think this is the best part of the program. Theo was the best part of the program. But what we're going to do now is actually we're going to give four theoretical scenarios, and Theo and I will have a discussion about them. So in other words, this is, obviously every situation is different, but this is modeling what a discussion, what a conversation between a doctor and a rabbi might be, and you'll see, it's interesting, based on nuances, the answers might be very different. Okay, so we'll sit over here. And can you see us?
No.
You brought your white coat, right?
Well, you have a white chair.
Oh, so what's
maybe
the
what do you suggest?
You know what, Theo? Maybe use that one, and I'll use this one. Yeah. We'll just stand. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Is that all right? And can you see us okay?
You don't have to be so distant.
How it is with rabbis and doctors.
So the first case is a patient who comes into the emergency room, a 70-year-old man. And he has pneumonia. And b'derech hateva, with what would normally be expected, he should do well. And the family is asking for guidance in terms of the most form and what they want guidance from the rabbi in terms of what to put down on the most form.
Okay, great. So this is, normally when you talk about end-of-life questions, the basic issue in terms of DNR, DNI, do not resuscitate, do not intubate, are normally the first form of questions, as is wonderful because the hospital raises the issue right when the patient comes in. So this is an interesting scenario. So just to think through the model that we just laid out a moment ago, Theo mentioned the pneumonia is something that really can be cured. I guess I would ask, does the patient have any other illnesses right now? In other words, maybe the patient has pneumonia, but maybe the patient also has incurable cancer too. You know, I guess I would ask that.
And the patient does not have incurable cancer. They do have thyroid problems and high blood pressure, but both are well controlled.
Okay. So one more question that I would ask in this circumstance would be, and this is always very difficult. We've had many conversations about this issue. Some patients, based on their age, based on their body, based on their level of what's a good word to use? Based on the level of frailty. Thank you very much. Based on the level of frailty, it could be that if they got to the point of resuscitation, even if they were resuscitated, even if they were saved, at that point, there's no way they'll be able to live another 6 months. And the experience of, let's say, having that broken, sometimes if the patient's very frail, they might have a broken rib from resuscitation, for example. So intubation, there are many patients, and I think this is, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, many, many patients are intubated. I think we hear horror stories about intubation. Many patients are intubated, and Baruch Hashem, a week later, days later, they're back, and their lives are saved, and they're walking around outside the hospital 3 weeks later. I mean, it happens. It really happens frequently. On the other hand, intubation can be an extremely uncomfortable thing. So I guess I would pose just as a follow-up question, if the pneumonia is curable and there's no other incurable illnesses, I guess I would still ask, based, you mentioned the person 70 years old. Some people 70 years old are very, very vibrant, and some are very frail. I guess I would ask, in this specific circumstance, if they would need to be resuscitated, if they would need to be intubated, would they be able to survive another 6 months?
Yes, and not frail.
Right, so then, hopefully none of this will be necessary, but then even if the person will have discomfort from a resuscitation or intubation, I would say it would be appropriate to ask that the resuscitation or intubation be done, which would mean that they would not sign a DNR or DNI form. I believe it's called full code,
yes.
Right? They would be full code patients. That would be that first example, I guess.
Yes.
Okay.
So the same patient gets admitted to the hospital and initially does well, but then his pneumonia gets worse. And when his pneumonia gets worse, he has a heart attack. And as part of the heart attack, he develops significant heart failure.
Okay, so then I would need to ask you, what are the patient's prospects of surviving another 6 months?
So we would have to say that it would be a medical miracle.
Okay, it would be a medical miracle. So is the patient currently in pain?
No.
Okay. So now this is a very interesting thing. So there could be aspects of treatment that wouldn't involve any pain for the patient. The patient's not currently in pain, and there could be procedures or aspects done that wouldn't involve pain. And I would say those should be done. On the other hand, as we mentioned before, it's very possible that resuscitation or intubation could cause the patient great pain. And at that point in the hospital stay, I would give new advice to the family. And I would say that they should sign a DNR or DNI. And a DNR and a DNI form. That's the advice I would give at that juncture. But, by the way, I'm sorry, I would still say that they have to make sure that nutrition, hydration, and oxygen are continued. So just to give, again, I don't know if in this specific circumstance it would be a likely scenario, but it's something that happens frequently. A very frequent question that I'm asked, is the patient isn't eating anymore, should a feeding tube be put in? But if the only method to receive nutrition is going to be the feeding tube, we've had conversations about this also many times there are other things that can be done other than a feeding tube, and the patient will receive the nutrition they need, but sometimes the only method, hopefully for an extended time, that the patient will receive nutrition is through a feeding tube, and in that case that's a basic to provide the nutrition, and as long as the patient could survive the implementation of the feeding tube, which sometimes is an issue, but as long as the patient could survive, it would be halakhically appropriate to install a feeding tube. And just as an aside, I personally know of many cases where a person had a feeding tube put in, and also they were later on, again, maybe not in this circumstance, but later on they walked out of the hospital and then they were eating normally, etc.
We had someone recently.
Yeah.
At Holy Cross.
Yeah, did you?
Yeah, we discussed it.
Oh, yes. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
So a little bit of a different scenario. Imagine the same patient, 70-year-old man coming to the hospital. He has pneumonia, and he has underlying metastatic lung cancer, and he's failed all chemotherapy. He's failed all conventional treatment. And his doctor hasn't yet, but was about to tell him that he's reached really the end of what's medically conventional, and anything beyond this would be really unconventional or experimental.
Right, so I would say the person really doesn't have to doesn't have to do anything. They must be in pain at the time also, I would assume, right? So at this point, this would be a classic example. It depends on the patient's wishes. But if the patient, and again, if one can't communicate with the patient, if the patient's family assumes the patient would rather not go through the pain, then they don't have to do any type of aggressive treatment. They don't have to do treatments that the treatment isn't painful, because they are in pain. But again, just, and certainly DNR, certainly DNI, but again, they still have to see to it that nutrition, hydration, and oxygen would still be provided. If I could just point out the nuance between the second example and the third example. The second example, correct me if I'm wrong, the patient was not currently in pain, but they were in an imminently fatal situation, which would mean that you wouldn't give treatment that would cause pain. The third example is the patient's in pain and in an imminently fatal situation, which would mean that you don't even have to be aggressive in treatment because, nebuch, this person is living in pain every moment. But you still, in either case, still have to provide nutrition, hydration, oxygen.
And the last case is, fast forward 7 or 8 months, the same patient has now been, actually, let's make it a year. He's been hospitalized 3-4 times over the last year, twice in the preceding 5 years, and he's lost a lot of weight. He's become increasingly frail, and each time he comes to the hospital, it's taken longer for him to get better. He's been less functional when he goes home, and it's become clear that he's now at the point where the pneumonia in itself is almost the equivalent of having cancer.
Just back up for a second. Yes. You said the same patient. Maybe describe.
Not the cancer. The first case, the very first case, the 70-year-old man who comes in with pneumonia, without cancer. So he doesn't have cancer. He comes in, he's had recurrent, repeated pneumonia with declining function and worsening overall status. And he's become extremely frail.
Right. So now, so I guess the first question I would ask you is, can he be cured from this pneumonia? Will he live another 6 months?
He could be cured from this pneumonia, but it's unlikely he'll live another 6 months.
Okay. And if you think it's unlikely he'll live another 6 months, again, unlikely, you don't mean 55%.
No.
You mean it would be a medical miracle if the person lived another 6 months. So if that was the case, then I would also say it would be reasonable to sign a DNR, DNI, because, again, those treatments would, upon entry to the hospital, I would say it would be reasonable to assign DNR, DNI. And honestly, in a patient in such a situation, again, every situation is different, but it might be worthwhile for the family to just have general DNR, DNI form even before waiting for it to be administered at the hospital, maybe doing something with the MOST form, something of that sort. But again, treatments that could prolong the person's life and would not be painful, the person's not in pain, right, those would still be appropriate, but resuscitation intubation would not be necessary. But again, there, for all you know, the patient says, I want every last moment, in which case it would be halakhically, ethically appropriate to follow the patient's wishes and not to do the DNR, DNI. So, should we take questions now?
There's 10 minutes.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Should we take questions?
We try to keep them general, because personal questions, they require a lot of details. We require probably more personal discussions. Either with the CEO or with the...
Maybe you.
Okay. In deference to the fact you're taking pictures for the whole thing, everybody's fine. I'm a little confused. What exactly is a DNR? You say you could, in some cases, have a DNI, and you're still maintaining hydration and nutrition.
Right, so thank you very much. Let me just repeat the question. So I had told you that you need to provide nutrition, hydration, and oxygen, right? So you'll correct me if I'm wrong. You can provide oxygen to a patient, but intubation is a much more dramatic measure. And, again, the fact that there's the oxygen mask on the patient, there are patients who you're providing oxygen to them, but internally they're not able to sustain. So that, it's not considered killing the patient to not intubate, if it's halakhically acceptable at the moment to not intubate. To not give them the basic oxygen is to not give them basic surrounding needs. To intubate is to help their internal dynamic. That's considered more aggressive level of treatment. Did I answer your question? Did that
okay.
Rabbi, you mentioned that irrespective of the situation, we're going to provide nutrition and hydration. And if a feeding tube is necessary, that falls in that situation. From a halakhic point of view, once a feeding tube has been put in, is it more difficult to remove it? If you gave the example of somebody who comes in with an incurable disease, molded for 6 months and is not able to feed themselves, in that situation, I get it really as a general, but in that situation, you would recommend that they put in a feeding tube so at least they can be fed. Does that halakhically make it that much more difficult?
Yes, and that's a very fair point. In general, there are definitely halakhic situations where a person, just to repeat the question was if to take out a feeding tube, if you have to put in a feeding tube, is it difficult to take out a feeding tube? And the answer is it's absolutely difficult to take out a feeding tube for the very same reason that it was important to put it in the first place. You are right that there are times in halakha doing X will create a situation where you can't undo X because undoing X is tantamount to killing the person. But to not feed them is also tantamount to killing the person. Honestly, what I think the practical takeaway is, sorry to beat the drum, but the importance of being in touch with our halakhic advisor throughout the process and making sure that our halakhic advisor is appropriately advised by the medical team, because, you know, the real practical application of what you're talking about is, let's say there was someone who was intubated, who halakhically didn't need to be intubated. And now to take them off of the intubator, generally speaking, to take them off the intubator might be killing them. And you can't take them off the intubator. And imagine what the frustration could be if, oh my gosh, now, just to be candid, many times you do have to put them on the intubator. But it's just good to be advised appropriately because theoretically it could be a situation where you didn't have to put them on the intubator. But once you put them on the intubator, you can't easily take them off.
Thank you.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is that I was told years ago the person you designate as the decision maker is better not to be a relative or a close relative, someone you trust that's out of the family that has the ability to make a decision better than someone under the pressure of the situation.
Interesting.
The question that I have is in the halakha living will, the RCA used to have one approach to doing this, and they changed. And the original approach was they had a section of the living will which gave specific questions, specific scenarios, and what did the person who's filling out the living will want to do in that situation, in those situations. But then they changed to a point where they don't put that in there. Why you think they might have changed?
Yeah, thank you. That's a wonderful point. Both points are wonderful. Thank you for raising them. Theo, you'll tell me if you agree or disagree, but I, as a rabbi, have been told by a doctor and a lawyer that they all think that the newer RCA form is better than the older one. Why? A lot of it, I think, has to do with points that we both made. There's a lot of variables. There's so many contingencies up in the air, and you're asking people to make decisions to appropriately answer all the medical circumstances. It's very hard to catch it all, and this is what I want. And so then you're putting decisions to things that maybe you didn't feel this way about X or didn't feel that way about Y. My understanding from different types of professionals was that over time it just became felt to be a more practical approach to just say this is who will represent me. And they'll do appropriately. I don't know if you would like to
agree.
Thank you.
Okay. If somebody is in their last months of a terminal illness and they're offered something that will give them more time, but it will be of less quality, in other words, they'll be somewhat sedated, can they opt not to have that in order to have better quality of time with their family, but a shorter period of time halakhically?
It's such a difficult question. It's a very powerful question. Obviously, it would depend on the details of the situation. You could probably guess what the first question I would ask would be. There's one thing you left out, which has to do with pain. That's, you said timing. You implied at least. I think it's a very difficult question. I don't want to say across the board, but if there'd be definitely strong grounds to say, if you view life as what God gives us, it's a difficult thing to answer, but it'd be strong grounds to say that they should do what they can to prolong their life longer. Could somebody make arguments about pain and emotional pain? Maybe you can make such arguments. It would really depend on the details, but it would be. I don't want to get too exact. It would be a very powerful question, and what it would really, in my mind, it would really touch on would be the issue of one person is in an imminently fatal illness. That was what you described, if I remember correctly. Is this pain? Is this not pain? Where does that issue of quality of life fall in? You might get different opinions about that. It's an interesting question. And it would depend a lot on the specifics on the ground.
Rabbi, you spoke about the last situation where the person did not halachically need to be, you know, any heroic measures, but the person himself wanted it. What about the opposite situation, where in this current situation, according to this, you know, the way this form is, the person has decided, I just don't ever want to be resuscitated or intubated, and then there might be a situation where it might be reversal, whatever, but the person's already decided, I don't want it. And so, halachically, you might say, you could or you need to, but the person has stated what they want.
Right. So, that's a very difficult question. There's a number of issues that play into that. Obviously, if the person signed the legal form, that has legal validity, I certainly wouldn't advise anyone to break the law. Do you know what I mean? That's the first thing, just clearly.
Or if they've made it known, maybe it isn't legal, but they've made it known to their
person. This is a difficult question, but honestly, if someone were to call me with that question, and I have been called with that question before, if this person has been assigned to care to the medical needs of this patient, you have a whole other issue, by the way, where you have different opinions within the family, right? That's also a very complicated question. Let's say there's one clear person, and it's their call, and it's their decision. I hate to say it. I would say that my understanding is the halachically appropriate thing would be to do what's dictated by halacha, which would be to still resuscitate the patient, still to do whatever needed to be done. It's very difficult. I appreciate the difficulty of the question that you raised, but that's what I would say.
Okay.
What about in a situation where the doctor or medical team might be indicating that administering artificial hydration nutrition in a dying patient can cause them, might even cause them more harm?
Oh, so that's
the question
is, and I'll be very candid. When I get that, I very frequently call Theo right after I hang up the phone. but theoretically speaking, I believe it's theoretically possible, right? There are cases where providing nutrition, I'll give you one example, and you'll tell me if this is correct. Sometimes a person is regularly aspirating, right? And mm-hmm. that literally by providing things to them, you could choke them mm-hmm. by providing things to them. In that case, there's certainly no mitzvah to starve a person, but there's also certainly no mitzvah to kill a person by providing to them. So there have been times where in those circumstances I've advised people to stop treatment, but it really depends on the specifics on the ground, but that's a very valid point. Thank you.
Okay,
Audrey?
I just might be not this crass, but I just think it's something that sometimes comes up in hospitals, at least maybe possibly in medical professionals' minds. So many of us are inured or sheltered from the cost of treatment because we have health insurance. But I do think sometimes the longer life runs into many, many dollars, and it could be that sometimes in the minds of medical professionals, they might be thinking we're spending, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on this patient that is going to die. Does that ever factor in? Is that ever something that would factor into a whole lot?
So, there's two issues that you're. One issue that's related to it, Moshe Feinstein's famous chuvas about this. Let's say you have a hospital that's dealing with. They only have so many things of medical equipment for so many patients, and there's another patient just came in with the same problem. This patient you can't cure. Moshe Feinstein's chuvas about that. The details, honestly, I don't remember exactly, but it's definitely discussed. Theoretically speaking, it would have to be a very high. You're saying from the family's perspective, cost for the family.
No, I'm saying we're generally sheltered from it.
Right. Thank God we are. Right.
Generally, right. But not everybody is.
Right.
And not everybody may always be. So
right.
There could actually be a situation where a family would be in a position of owing.
Right, it would be a very serious question. It would be a very serious question. It could be a factor in a very extreme way. I just want to give, and your point is appropriate because hopefully we don't get there, but it's possible. I do want to give a scenario that I've had before, which has been a family has called me up and they've said the hospital refuses to do X. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, the hospital refuses to do X. So I'm just, you know, if you can only do what you can do. In other words, if theoretically you might want to get legal minds involved, whatever it is, but for the facts on the ground, if the hospital won't do it, the hospital won't do it. Could it theoretically be, I don't know how practical this issue is, could it theoretically be that one hospital won't and one hospital will? By the way, this issue is extremely relevant. We'll do it another time, God willing. Hospice, this definitely comes up. This is one thing that people need to be aware of when they sign up for hospice, which there are many times it's appropriate to sign up for hospice. That's just a teaser. But the bottom line is, theoretically, if hospital X won't and hospital Y will, it could very well be, depending on the circumstances, that would be appropriate to transfer the patient to hospital Y.
Okay, we'll take one more question, but we're reading over time right now.
Just a comment, first of all, about the loose leaf binder, I found it very crucial. Not a spiral notebook, but a binder like you have in school with divisions of list of medications, list of insurances, list of questions to the rabbi, list of questions to the doctors, and even if you're at 3 o'clock in the morning, you can write it down, and to give a copy of that list to the doctor when you communicate with them, I think would be very helpful. Number two, have you found that there's been a trend in hospitals to kind of push families to sign DNRs? And number three, you had said that over 50% of the doctor who did that little experiment about guessing, how long someone was going to live and that they guessed the wrong way. So really, it seemed to be a contradiction to what was said about, is a person going to live, asking these questions, is a person going to live 6 months or more?
So both, I'll take one. So the third question first. So I should frame the experiment better. It was with patients in an intensive care unit at the University of Chicago, and it was whether or not they would live or die within that hospitalization. In general, the 6 month is easier, and doctors, I think in general, 6 months to a year, we're much better at that, and there's much less difficulty with saying who's going to survive 6 months or a year. So don't confuse the short-term days in the ICU versus the 6 months to a year. And it's not to say that we're always right about 6 months, but bederech hateva, in the way things normally work. Your second question was a push to make patients DNR. I don't think there's a push to make patients DNR. I think that there were a large number of lawsuits. There was a huge patient outcry with wrongful life lawsuits, not just wrongful death. And the lawmakers and the hospitals responded with, okay, we're going to get everyone's opinion up front. And so that means that when you come in the hospital, we're going to ask you if you what you want. There's no value judgment. We'll do whatever you want. But we want to know up front. The problem with that, the subtlety, is that my definition of quality of life as average physician is different to what the halachic definition is and what you might want. So I'm looking at the patient nebuch in the bed and thinking, that's a terrible quality of life. And we already discussed that I'm likely to be wrong. So I might frame the question in a way that you're more likely to answer yes. But that doesn't mean hospitals are pushing, and doctors should not be pushing. It's a value-neutral question, and it's not a threatening question. It should not be. The way that we're trained to ask the question is value-neutral.
Okay, this has been extremely valuable. You can see that it can go on for quite a while, and it will go on, because you always have questions, and hopefully you will take advantage of the resources available. Constantly rabbi, and Rabbi may be able to limit and some more questions, but for this, I want to just be respectful. Now I have to set aside this program. We'll try to have more programs. Your ideas are welcome. I also have some materials. C.R. Heller also has admitted himself available for a little bit after the session, so if you'd like to sign up and have to come up with questions if you have, that'd be great. If you'd like to ask for specific programs or ideas or things that you need, that'd be great. We have 50 topics. We have almost twice as many people in this room. And all these are available online. So there's nothing magical about what I've got here. It's for the Passage Shell MSP sources, the healthcare proxy by the Clinical Council, which is available online. I also just made copies of your availability here. Your Aguda version also available. I have a copy of it here. If you want to be taking one, take one or the other so that the person can make it available to themselves. There's also the Marilyn Morse form if you'd like to take that, advantage of that. There's also something called the MS card, which allows you to have something on you in case nobody knows what's going on. And you can also get it at online. And the Rabbi Zohn, Z-O-H-N, is called the MS card. And I've made 50 copies of all these resources. So take advantage of one of these and see if they can help you in the future. But also, please talk to people and see what they need to do to answer these specific questions. Thank you very much for coming. It's an interesting discussion.
I would suggest, if possible, to put the website as a URL or the full website so people can have
it. We'll try to make it available on the show list site as well as the and when the tape of this is available, because some of you may want to go back to it, we'll try to see if we can make it available. But it's a little difficult because the technology is going to have to require something else than just posting it because it's that kind of a situation. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.